KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Sarah Lacey is founder and CEO of Pando Daily, which has described itself as a no-holds-barred investigative journalism website covering the tech industry. She called out Uber's toxic sexist culture back in 2014 and has stared down both internet mobs and actual physical mobs. But there was one thing Sarah Lacey was afraid of: becoming a mother. She tells us why next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Here's how tech journalist Sarah Lacey describes in her new book what happened when she had her first kid. She writes, "You know that scene in the movies when someone is defusing a bomb and they have no idea if they've cut the right wire or not? They sort of close their eyes and brace and then slowly open them, maybe one at a time. They are alive. The bomb is defused. Nothing changed." That's what happened when I had Eli. I was still there. Even better, actually. I was me plus. Everything I'd been told about the great disability of motherhood was a lie. Lacey's book is titled A Uterus is a Feature, Not a Bug, The Working Woman's Guide to Overthrowing the Patriarchy. Sarah Lacey, welcome to Forum.
Thank you so much. My daughter used to go to preschool across the city, and I have listened to the show every day for 3 years as I ease from mother zone to work zone. And it's I'm so excited to be here.
Well, we're excited to have you. And what had you been told about motherhood? What was the lie?
The lie was that you can't have it all. The lie was that you will become distracted and disabled and weak, and that you'll have to choose, and that you'll have this, you will never be as good as you had been as an employee or an entrepreneur or CEO or whatever you are professionally. You just will, as a fundamental law of nature, you will not be as good as you were. So you better get a lot out of your career before you have children. And then even worse, even scarier, was this idea of this biological imperative that was behind the myth of the opt-out revolution when I was coming out of college. And it was this idea of once you hold that baby in your arms. And it was this idea that everything that had been such a huge part of my identity up until now in my life would be erased and wiped away to the
because
point.
Because you just want to stay with your child?
Yes, because your mother instinct would take over and it would be all you were. And to the point where even in super liberal, woke Silicon Valley, I remember right before I had Eli, I had to go to China 6 weeks after giving birth to do a conference for TechCrunch that we've been planning for 2 years. So it had predated me getting pregnant. I had worked so hard on this conference. I was not going to not go do it. And I had to go 6 weeks after giving birth. And so I just kind of hoped I had a safe delivery. And I remember having dinner with some journalists and a Silicon Valley venture capitalist who had known me my whole career and actually wound up being a backer of Pando because this person believed in my ambition so much. And yet even this person actually made a bet with me that I would not get on the plane to China because he was like, once you see your son, there's no way. It's going to take over who you are. We made a $100 bet. I made $100 off of a billionaire because he was so convinced that even me, who'd been this obsessive, obnoxious journalist for all these years, would hold her baby and become a different human being.
And it's not like it wasn't magical when you did have Eli. It's just that it didn't change fundamentally who you were. But I also found it interesting that it was your own mother who was among the people who really helped perpetrate this lie to you. She said something along the lines of that she wouldn't have been able to be a perfect mother and a perfect teacher at the same time. So she decided she needed to sort of split her life into these two phases.
And she did the opposite of what I did. I focused on my career first and didn't have kids until I was 35. And I really had to feel like I had done everything. And if this thing happened, I'd be okay with it. My mom did the opposite. She had five kids, and I was the youngest of five kids. And when I was in kindergarten, she was an academic with multiple degrees, absolutely brilliant. And she started teaching, and she taught at a K through 12 private school that I got to go to. So we still spent time together every day, which is probably one of the only reasons she did it. And yeah, she used to always say to me about, you know, this period of her life when everything she'd worked for was just kind of fallow. And my dad had this amazing career as an academic. And she was like, you know, I just felt I couldn't do both perfectly.
And your other argument is not only can you still fundamentally be who you are and have a career and be a good mother, but that being a mother actually makes you a better employee or enhances a career. Can you explain
a better
that?
Everything, like not just a better employee. It made me a better employer. It made me a better boss. It made me a better entrepreneur. It made me a better writer. It made me obviously a better human being. I mean, I think most mothers know that. Like, there's so much you have to get outside of your own selfish needs when you are just growing a baby. It's not even on the outside yet. But that's what was so stunning to me, was like all the ways I changed made me so much better, to the point where I was like, why didn't I do this sooner? Why did I put this off for so long? I mean, there's four sort of major things that I noticed that have turned up in a lot of research and have really rung true to a lot of other women I've talked to. You know, one, which is most obvious, is productivity. I mean, mothers just get more done, particularly working mothers, in short periods of time. And there's studies that have backed this up. The Federal Reserve Bank did a study that showed that right after you have a baby, you have a 15% hit in productivity, which is pretty amazingly low, frankly, given how it feels to come home with a baby and go back to work. And given how many women in this country, something like 85%, don't have paid maternity leave, you take a 15% hit. But after that, once your kids get older, once they get in school, you are more productive and remain more productive through the rest of your career. And mothers of multiple children get jumps in productivity with each child. So you absolutely become more productive. You become way more laser focused. Employees who I've talked to, particularly those who employ single moms, say those are the employees who are like never gossiping. They're not taking long lunches because they've got this window in which they've got to get everything done. You have this sort of warrior stamina. Because you have to prove yourself so much more than everyone else. And so you work through situations that, you know, you probably wouldn't if you didn't have that on the line. And frankly, your children's future on the line, because now you're providing for them as much as for yourself. You're their female role model. And that clarifies a lot. Also, empathy. You become a way more empathetic manager. You know, I grew up in newsrooms, so I grew up in environments where you screamed at people in order to get results, where you threatened to fire people. You cannot threaten to fire a child who will not potty train. You've got to crawl inside their head and figure out how to motivate them. That made me a better manager overall. And lastly, just creative problem solving. Oh my God, parenting is constant creative problem solving, and building a company is constant creative problem solving. And I found doing those at the same time was like cross-training those muscles in different ways. And I was stunned at the things that I could come up with to save my company from extinction, and the things that I could come up with to like get my son who has anxiety on a plane to go see his grandparents when it's just me and two kids, which the answer was dressing in costume. We dress in costume everywhere we go.
And your company is Pando Daily or Pando.com, which mm-hmm. is an investigative journalism site that looks at the tech industry. And I think one of the experiences that you detail quite a bit in your book is the experience with Uber, and how years even before Susan Fowler's blog post came out about sexism and misogyny at Uber, and of course we know that Travis Kalanick resigned this year, you had called out that culture and had been targeted. First, can you talk a little bit about that experience, what they were going after you
for? Yeah, it was pretty horrible. You said in your intro that we'd done this in 2014. We actually started criticizing Uber's culture in 2012. We were very early to this, and our earliest concerns had to do with this libertarian ideology that was behind the company, where it really viewed drivers as, you know, broken eggs in an omelet, frankly, and as something that could be repluggable in widgets in this thing driving this. And I think Paul Carr, my business partner, wrote that piece, not me. And it was incredibly prescient, because right now we are seeing drivers sleeping in parking lots of Safeways and enduring real physical problems, not being able to like stop to go to the bathroom in order to make ends meet. And I think that's kind of the piece that has almost gotten lost in all the talk about Uber's misogyny and treatment of women, frankly. But we had started with that. And then we were early on writing about the troubling pattern of background checks not quite working. And in one of the stories we were doing on that, what disturbed me was the senior management was telling my reporters off the record, oh, well, these girls were dressed provocatively and they were drunk. And I just found it so, on a human level, disturbing, but also shocking. Shocking to say that about anyone who would be sexually assaulted in this day and age, period. But I found it absolutely horrific that these women were assaulted using their product. They were their customers. And their response was calling reporters and saying this about them, implying these women were asking for it. At the same time, Uber was going to city councils and state legislatures and saying laws should be remade in order to suit them because they were helping people get home drunk. It was just disgusting. There were several other incidents that sort of snowballed right after that. And I hit a point in 2014 where I just thought this company was absolutely misogynistic top to bottom in how they viewed their drivers, how they viewed their passengers, how they treated employees. And, you know, I ended up writing a post saying I was deleting Uber from my phone and that, you know, there never was proof that Ubers were safer than cabs. It's something they've repeated a lot, but they've never proven. But I felt even if that is true, I don't know what would happen if I was assaulted in a Lyft. I know what would happen if I was assaulted in an Uber and they'd go around to reporters like mine, shaming me and slamming me and saying I was a drunk slut who deserved it, which is essentially what they were saying. And I felt like any woman I loved, I did not want them using that service. Certainly me, certainly getting in it with my children. That post got picked up and got some attention. But look, frankly, Pando's a small publication. We were never going to hurt Uber's valuation or their user numbers. But what we were hurting was the reputation in their valley, which was hurting their ability to recruit and how people felt about going to work there. And so they decided, and we were really like the lone voice calling this out. So they decided that they had to shut me up at any cost. We shared investors in common. There had already been pressure points that hadn't worked. You know, obviously they weren't going to speak at our conferences. We don't really do access journalism. We didn't care. So all the normal pressures that they apply to other journalists weren't working. So they came up with a plan, in order to, you know, in the words of an executive who described this to Ben Smith, go after me by going after my family.
And I think at some point you even wrote about that some of the board members shared their security detail with you because they were concerned about people following you.
Yeah, one of my investors did.
One of your investors.
Yeah, and it was because it really – so, I mean, the threat was specifically doing Oppo research, which is not Googling someone. I mean, it's pretty ugly. And
yes.
And we've frankly seen Uber do this since. I mean, they said at the time, we would never do that. Emil Michaels was drunk at a party. It came up in decrypted emails in a court case later. They had done this to a plaintiff's attorney that was suing them. Susan Fowler said they've done these things to her. And, you know, the most disturbing example was, again, a woman raped using their service in India. The same guy, Emil Michaels, and his lieutenant got her medical records and were going to use that to smear her. So Oppo Research is not looking someone up on Google and, you know, putting some mean comments on a thread. It is obtaining medical records, is following you and your children, is digging through trash. It is incredibly ugly and disgusting. And on top of that, this was a company that was putting my face and my identity out there as public enemy number one. And there are millions of drivers, some of whom have not passed background checks in cities. It was a very scary time for me and my family.
It was a crazy incident, and there's so much that stands out about it. But one in particular was related to this topic, was that you didn't talk about how hard it was to go through all this and have to care for two kids at the same time. In fact, it was the opposite for you. You talked about your kids being almost like your saving grace in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm probably going to get teary-eyed even talking about this again. I think if I had not, during that period of time, had my children to come home to. And also, like, I don't think I would have fought as hard. I mean, I think their tactical...
You call it maternal rage.
Yeah, I mean, their tactical error, frankly, not to give Emil Michael advice on the next time to smear a woman, but their tactical error was seeing my sign of weakness, the vulnerability to exploit, was my children. When you come out and say, let's destroy her family, let's put her children in danger, I mean, I just felt like I like reared up like a mama bear. It was just like, what happens in the natural world when you do that? And I also felt like that maternal rage wasn't just for my kids. It was for other women, because he was very clear to Ben Smith. I was only the first critic he was going to dismantle this way. And I knew other female journalists didn't have the luxury that I did in controlling my own company and having a very loud megaphone to go after this. And I wanted just every time, the next time any woman said Uber tried to do this, for them to be believed.
And they were, ultimately, as allegations came out. But again, it boils down to that point that you were making earlier, that being a mother does not take away from your value, but actually adds value to your workplaces and as you were saying, in general. But at the same time, isn't that predicated on the fact that women have support at home to help take care of children?
Well, I don't.
But you did at the time.
At the time, right? I did have a nanny. I haven't since my daughter was 2.5, though. So for the last couple of years, I haven't. I was getting divorced at the time, so I didn't have a husband, and I have no family nearby. So I didn't really have a lot of support, and I don't really now.
So how do you manage that then? Because there are only so many hours in the day, right? And so you want to devote the time that you need to your children, or that, you know, you want to be there for their soccer award ceremonies or that kind of thing, right? But you can't. So.
Well, I'm lucky in that I work for myself, so I have a lot of flexibility. So I spend about 11 hours a day working. I spend about 6 hours a day with my kids, whether that's getting them up, getting them ready, getting them fed, picking them up, doing homework, all that. And then I sleep about whatever the balance of that is. So 11 hours a day is a lot of hours to work if you're really productive. I feel like I wrote a book in 9 months, way quicker, by the way, than I've written my previous two books when I had when I didn't have children or a company I was running. I mean, again, this productivity thing is really an amazing superpower mothers have. But I think it's also like my kids, I've picked the right environment for our family. My kids go to a school which is 8-to-5 curriculum. And so they're not shoved in aftercare, and they get a lot of the like sort of extras that you get from school during that 8-to-5. So I'm not running them around town to different practices. It's a school of all working moms. And so I feel very supported and not guilted in that community, and the moms help each other out. So I think sometimes it's like finding the right resources within a city so that you feel empowered to do what you need to do. And also, frankly, I was the breadwinner in my family. And as a divorced woman, I don't get child support. So if I want to keep my kids in San Francisco, I got to work this hard. Well, and my kids and I talk about that.
Can I just ask you quickly, what school is 8-to-5?
So I can't tell you on the air because of safety. Oh. Because it's my kids. But I will tell you off the air. And it's the best kept secret in San Francisco.
Okay. Well, so I hear all of that. And you mentioned the very top that, you know, this lie that women can't have it all. But yet, you remember that Anne Marie Slaughter article for The Atlantic that said women really can't have it all. And that really resonated with a lot of women.
So it did. I had a problem with that article at the time, frankly,
But why would it resonate with a lot of women, you think, you know?
So I have two things. I think in the case of Anne Marie Slaughter, she had a very specific set of circumstances for why she, quote unquote, couldn't have it all. She was commuting. She had children who were teenagers. She had a very restrictive job for the hours she could be there. She, you know, I may not have an every woman situation, but she also did not. And so to me, what I found damaging about that article was basically extrapolating from a very unique set of circumstances that women couldn't have their own identity as professional women and have children. I think that was damaging and irresponsible. I do think, though, it also has to do with our mindset. I mean, part of why I want to overthrow the patriarchy is one of the patriarchy's most devious tools and weapons is this voice of guilt and perfection that gets put in working moms' heads.
So you're saying that this push and pull of the career and parenting, or
that
the
you
guilt
have to
that
be
you're associated
perfect
with it
when it's like
is the patriarchy.
No one expects that. This idea, this belief that if you're not totally available to your boss, you're a bad employee. Most people who aren't mothers aren't totally available to their bosses. If you're not totally available to your children, you're a bad mother. Is that really a good thing to be? First of all, kids are in school 8-to-5. What do they need me for there during those hours? So I think part of it is that guilt that's put in. I mean, remember, we live in a country where 40% of Americans think it's bad for society if women work. That is a lot of institutional guilt we're carrying around. So that's part of it. And lastly, I think it's what is having it all to you? Like, I'm 30 pounds heavier than I would like because I eat fast food and I don't work out. I'm literally wearing like total mom drop-off gear today. I'm wearing like a sports bra and a t-shirt and jeans, and I haven't showered because like it was more important for me to spend that extra time with my kids today. My house is a mess. Like, what I love is spending those 6 hours a day with my children and being part of their school community, and I love like absolutely destroying and slaying the patriarchy via Pando or this book or whatever. And it's like everything else, like I'm totally cool with piles of laundry.
We're talking with Sarah Lacey. She's the founder and CEO of Pando.com and also the founder and CEO of ChairmanMom.com, which we'll talk more about later in the hour. She's a journalist, tech entrepreneur, and an author. And her new book is A Uterus is a Feature, Not a Bug, The Working Woman's Guide to Overthrowing the Patriarchy. Clearly, there's also a nod to the tech industry there, since that's also the industry you cover. But I want to talk with you about the word patriarchy, because you said something funny in your book. You wrote, somehow saying the word patriarchy makes you sound like some kind of unhinged extremist. So talk about why that word, why it was so important for you to use that.
To obsessively use it. I use it a lot. What's funny, I mean, think of how much things have changed in 4 years. I mean, so 4 years ago, and I say 4 years because that's when Lean In came out. And I know because I was pregnant with my daughter when I was reading it. And Lean In was so radical. It was so radical. It was like no, I mean, I'd spent 20 years in Silicon Valley and no one talked about motherhood the way Sheryl did. No one wanted to talk about being a woman. It was really brave and radical at the time. And now here we are 4 years later and so much of Lean In seems really quaint. I mean, during that time, you couldn't even self-identify as a feminist. That was like man-hating, like not that long ago.
So when she's talking about, you know, breastfeeding or having to manage the needs of women and being in meetings, all
and,
that kind of stuff.
And this idea that the only way you can do this is the spouse who will help you out.
Oh, the
which
50-50.
Is, you know, I'm all for men doing laundry, but negotiating if you can have a career with your husband, not so much. But, you know, remember, like, then Jennifer Lawrence was like, well, I don't want to call myself a feminist. I just think women should get paid. It's like, that's what a feminist is. And it's like this idea that the concept of feminism got so pushed and polarized to a place where it's people thought it was crazy. People thought it was man-hating. People thought all of these things. And it's like patriarchy was even farther. I mean, patriarchy sounds like you are like tinfoil hat. You think men are actively keeping you down, which is, if you just think about it, the same way we sort of reclaimed and peeled back feminism to mean, wait a minute, all this means is I think men and women should be equal. All a patriarchy means is, do we live in a world, in a business industry, or your corner of whatever, wherever you live, where it is dominated by powerful men and women don't have equal voice or control? Yes, that is everywhere. That,
and that is
a patriarchy.
Yes.
Well, but the idea that we got so pushed into a corner where it's extreme to even say that, even though all of the data shows it.
So this is a question I have for you, because you were talking about women who will sometimes say things, vote against their own interests, say things that are sexist, or say things that you think hold up the patriarchy. And you often view them as victims of the patriarchy, and that's why they're doing it, right? Mm-hmm. And that may be true in some cases, but I wonder if that feels like a satisfying explanation as to why women still feel that incredible guilt, right, of not being able to devote everything to their bosses and everything to their children, which is an expectation that you're saying is the patriarchy. Do you ever, have you felt that too sometimes? Like it's just too easy an explanation that women have just sort of internalized the patriarchy if they're struggling with this?
To me, it's very satisfying because it's rooted in compassion and not that women, and it's rooted in self-survival.
So say more about the compassion.
Yeah, I mean, there's two big forces at work when it comes to sexism and misogyny.
And we're coming up on a break, so
yeah.
So
there's benevolent sexism and hostile sexism. Now, hostile sexism is what we're seeing every day play out in the news cycle with women who are being sexually assaulted and power dynamics being exploited. And even, you know, go look at my ads on Twitter. There's probably a bunch of people saying awful things about me right now. That is like hostile sexism. It's overt. Benevolent sexism is really tricky. And before I started researching this book, I had no idea how powerful it was.
Well, I want to talk with you more about benevolent sexism after the break. We're talking with Sarah Lacey. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Pando.com founder, tech journalist, author, and entrepreneur Sarah Lacey about her new book, The Uterus is a Feature, Not a Bug, The Working Woman's Guide to Overthrowing the Patriarchy. It's part memoir, part manifesto for mothers that tries to get at some old yet very persistent ideas about motherhood. And it challenges the biases against mothers in our culture. And one of the ways that this plays out, Sarah Lacey, just before the break you were saying, is through what you define as benevolent sexism. What is benevolent sexism?
So benevolent sexism is when men and women find a way to limit women and put them in a box, but in a way that seems to mean well. So one of the reasons maternal bias is one of the most overt forms of bias women face at work, and by the way, not just mothers, all kinds of women face at work, is because a lot of people don't believe it's sexism. Because they believe that they're doing you a favor to deny you a promotion or to slot you into a job that doesn't involve late nights or travel. Because, again, you can be, if you're not available to your boss, bad employee. If you're not available to your children all the time, bad mother. So they're helping you. This is an example of benevolent sexism. We also see it at play when, you remember you brought up Susan Fowler earlier, when she came out and wrote about just the astounding sexism she'd experienced at Uber. There were, you know, several women who put up Medium posts being like, look, it's just, it's not a culture for everybody. You saw this sadly in the aftermath of the Brock Turner trial. The swimmer rapist from Stanford, where, you know, childhood female friends of his wrote letters saying he's not a rapist. These are just kids who are drinking too much. It's like benevolent sexism is a way of carving off women from each other. It's a way of complimenting and flattering the right kind of woman so that they help hold up what this patriarchy is. And the easiest way to look at it is the difference in how someone like Donald Trump talks about Hillary Clinton and how he talks about his daughter and how he can say, look, I support women's careers. My daughter does great work for me. But his daughter looks a certain way, dresses a certain way, makes him money, doesn't challenge his position. So you can think of benevolent sexism a little bit like a mafia racket. You can think of it as the carrot of a misogynistic patriarchy, whereas hostile sexism is the stick. It's the way of flattering and complimenting the right kind of woman, which, by the way, is usually privileged white women who don't question men, and getting them to kind of do the patriarchy's dirty work. And I have to say, and I acknowledge it in this book, I was absolutely a victim of benevolent sexism, did not realize it for much of my career, was very cool dude for a lot of my 20s, had
no
idea.
And not just a victim, you mean you're saying you also even push some of these ideas.
Yeah, but that's to me why it's a satisfying explanation, going back to your question, because I look back, I did experience aspects and I was sympathetic to women and I don't think I queen bead women and I don't think I did some of those things, but at the same time, I would say things like, I just haven't experienced this level of sexism in Silicon Valley, and it's because I was a beneficiary of benevolent sexism. I was the right kind of woman.
Well, we've got lots of calls coming in, and let's start with Kim in Berkeley. Hi, Kim. I'm sorry, Kim. We're having trouble with your line. I think we'll try one more, and we'll hopefully you can call back on a different one, Kim. Francesca in Livermore. Hi, Francesca.
Hi. I heard your speaker talking earlier about somebody else's book on this topic being damaging and misleading, and I would have to say the same about your current speaker. I'm sorry, I have lived in the Bay Area my entire life. I've been working in Silicon Valley. I had twins, and I retired. Most of us have to commute for work. Most women are working for corporations that require your presence. They require certain things of you as an employee, and then you do have to make choices about how to parent in that set of circumstances. Not all of us have our own companies, our own tech company, our own journalism, where we can work at home, where we have the flexibility to make our own hours.
Francesca, thank you. Sarah Lacey.
Yeah, I mean, as I said when I was bringing up that very point, my story isn't totally relatable to everyone else either. And, you know, I think everyone's story is their own story. But the point is, because that's your story doesn't also mean it's everyone's story. In my case, I made decisions that cut the amount of money I could make. I made decisions that affected my income. I made decisions in order to have that. I do have an office, by the way, and run a company. I don't work from home. Flexibility is a major, major advantage for me. I will will say, going back to maternal bias, while I said it's the most overt form of bias women face, it only impacts 60% of women. There are 40% of companies where women, you know, don't have to make those choices and are able to have a full career and have children. So again, choice. I totally honor any mother's choice to make whatever choice they want. I just think because some women feel they've had to make an unfair sacrifice doesn't mean it is endemic in having children. And it's also kind of an American thing. You know, this is one of the only countries in the world where we don't have maternity leave. This is one of a few countries in the world where there's not subsidized childcare. Part of what puts us in this bind, and I hear the anger in her voice and I respect that, part of what puts us in this bind where women get angry with other women on this topic is we live in one of the only countries in the world that doesn't support mothers as part of policy and leaves it all on them.
Well, Nancy writes, energy levels vary. Some women, like the guests, do have enough to cope and even excel at both motherhood and a career, but many do not. A friend of mine chose lesser work so she didn't need to work more than 40 hours a week while her daughter was in school. It's pretty harsh to characterize the saying you can't have it all as a lie. I guess the question I have, too, is in your book, Sarah Lacey, you were very willing to say that if it weren't for your child's nanny at the certain period of time that you had a nanny, that you wouldn't have been able to do everything that you wanted to be able to do, and that you made sure to say that and hold that up because you also don't want to deny how significant that work is.
Yeah, because that's also a kick-ass professional woman who helped me out. I don't want to steal her labor by any stretch. But I think, again, like what I'm hearing in a lot of these comments is this like guilt. I'm not saying anyone needs to work as many hours as I do. I'm not saying anyone needs to start a company. It sounds like what she's saying is this person made a choice in order to work 40 hours a week to spend more time with their kids. I think that sounds amazing. I mean, I think what this is all bringing out is this guilt. People are hearing from me, you have to do this in order to be good. I'm not saying that. I'm saying every mother, every woman should be able to make the choices she wants that are best for her and best for her family. And it's those choices that women usually don't have.
Well, what I also heard was this question in your book of what would it be like for women if being a mother or having the capacity to be a mother was actually viewed completely differently than you feel like it is in our current patriarchal paradigm, mm-hmm. right? What if we actually saw it as an asset? How might that change the way women approach this question of career or children?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it is definitely difficult to have a newborn and be working a demanding job. But we do a lot of difficult things that we celebrate as a culture. You know, I can't even imagine running a marathon. I have friends who do these super marathons where you run 100 miles and they describe you to turn your body into a machine of like taking salt tablets and putting this protein in order to keep going. I mean, it is surely something that could kill you if you were not prepared. And yet that's seen as an amazing accomplishment. Building a company. We all know the odds are against us that company will survive. And yet it's seen as something where failure is good and it'll make you stronger on the other end no matter what. And yet when it comes to being a working mom, somehow we see it as you are set up to fail from the beginning and don't even try. And there's something wrong with you even trying. There are many times I fail constantly in my life on, you know, little ways, both as a CEO and as a mother. But I guess I just refuse to have this idea of perfection or guilt in my head that says somehow this is the only part of the American dream, which you must do absolutely perfectly, or why did you even try?
Well, Rob tweets, as a son of a single working mom, I agree with Sarah Lacey that it's completely possible to raise good, healthy kids from this place. The shaming is silly and erroneous. And I think he means the shaming of single moms. The question I have, too, is you mentioned that your book, yes, while it's about motherhood, it's also about how women generally are treated just based on the capacity that they could have children mm-hmm. by employers, especially employers or bosses who are men. And you were saying something about how this happens right after, say, they announce their engagement. There becomes a sort of question mark in everybody's head of, okay, well, when are you going to leave? And because you're going to go out on maternity leave or something.
Yeah,
like
I mean,
that.
A lot of employers see these women's uteruses ticking time bombs. And I think so much of what was dangerous about the opt-out revolution press, you know, several decades ago, and this idea that there's this biological imperative that women would no longer want to achieve, is it justifies, it gives a fiduciary fiduciary duty to an unfair bias, where whether or not a woman is pregnant or not, you feel like that's not someone whose career you want to invest in. And, you know, I think it's shocking to me that people don't view it as sexism when it pretty much only impacts young women, and it impacts them whether they've had children or not. And again, I talk about in the book, when I was interviewing at Business Week in my late 20s when I got engaged, I was outright asked if I was going to have children. I wasn't planning on having children at the time. And I told them that, and they made it clear they wouldn't have hired me if the answer had been different.
Hmm. Well, let's hear from Berkeley in Oakland. Hi, Berkeley.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for this conversation. I agree with a lot of what's being said. I'm a super strong feminist. I was raised by a mom who was part of the feminist movement in the 70s. And I chose to stay home with my kid when he was born, and I feel very lucky that I got to do that. And I think my biggest issue is that women shouldn't have to go back to work. If they want to, that's great. There's actually a lot of research showing that it's really important for women to stay home with their children for the first 2 years. That's a very foundational part of their lives. And I'd like to know what you're doing to change the system and to make it, you know, you've mentioned a couple of times that we don't have paid maternity leave, where, you know, a lot of states we don't. But, you know, what are you doing to make it so that women don't have to go back to work if they don't want to? You have a platform. You're a journalist. You have this voice. And I would really like, you know, women who work low-paying jobs to not have to go back after 2 weeks, you know, with a newborn. That's ridiculous. It's bad for mothers. It's bad for families. It's bad for a country. And it's really bad for children.
Berkeley, thanks.
I could not agree more. I think the biggest failing of the women's movement in this country is that we don't have generous paid parental leave, both for men and women. And there's a ton of research in this book on the benefits for society with that. One of the late in the book, there's actually a chapter on Iceland. I traveled to Iceland and did a ton of reporting there on the way they do parental leave and the way it has had an amazing transformation on the society there. That's a society where 2/3 of the children are born to single mothers. And there's a lot of pressure on those single mothers, and yet they get a ton of support in the ecosystem. One of the most fascinating things about Iceland, it doesn't have the most generous paid leave, but what it does is it has 9 months, and 3 months is flexible. 3 months is only for the mom, and 3 months is only for the dad, and the family loses it if the dad doesn't take it. And when I first heard that, I thought, wow, that's brilliant, because it gets the dad over this hump of the mom does everything at the very beginning and builds his confidence. What I didn't realize was the ramification it has in hiring, where employers see young men and young women who are engaged as equally likely to disappear for several months if they hire them. And that's one reason Iceland has the top glass ceiling index rating, according to The Economist, in terms of women's involvement in the workplace. There's a lot of other policies they do well. But I think, exactly like this caller just said, it is this one of the things that's so pernicious about the way mothers are treated in this culture is we both have to prove our commitment and reprove our commitment to our employers in unfair ways that men certainly aren't held to when we come back after having children. At the same moment, we don't give them leave to recover. And even the mothers who get leave are guilted out of taking that leave. I quote a study called Elephant in the Valley, where I think about half of the women surveyed in Silicon Valley, where we have some of the most generous paid leaves, didn't take it or cut it short because they felt they had to. The way we think about paid leave in this country is as like a luxurious vacation, not as something that you should have. And I think that's one reason women get to this point where they feel they can't have it all, where they feel untenable, because we force them back into a hostile situation to reprove themselves at their weakest, most vulnerable possible moment.
Well, let's hear from more callers. Kim in Berkeley. Hi, Kim.
Hi. I don't know why this conversation feels so upsetting to me, but I think this, from what I hear from the beginning, or whatever the title of the book is, the myth of having it all. And I think I'm very frustrated because as a woman who's aging and as a woman whose children are getting older, yeah, certain doors are closing. And it's not around guilt, but it's around when you have several responsibilities, you do have to make a choice as to where you're going to put your resources, where you're going to put your time, and where you're going to put your energy. And as I get older and as my children's needs change, I have realized that I have decided to put more and more and more of my energy into them and not into me and not into some of the things that I wanted to do for myself. And I don't have guilt around that. I don't have shame around that. But I think it's really important sometimes to be honest that my responsibilities have impacted some of the other things that I had intended to do. So it feels like, oh, there's no myth. You can really do everything. And I try to tell my girls, and I'm really conflicted around it, like, you don't need to grow up to be a superhero because you can't do everything. You can't do 70% of the household while he doesn't. You can't do 70% of the homework while he doesn't. And then you do 100% of your work and 100% of taking them everywhere. You do make choices. So I think I get a little frustrated because somebody who sees myself as a feminist also feels like I have every right to say that having the number of responsibilities I have means that some things have to get cut short.
Kim, thank you for that. Sarah Lacey.
Yeah, I mean, again, I totally get why this is such an emotional issue. I think you're unfortunately really mishearing my argument. The reason I think the patriarchy should be overthrown is because it is an unfair system. It sounds to me what you're describing is you trying to be your best you, you trying to be a feminist, you trying to raise these like amazing, strong children while being in an unfair system. I assure you, no part of my book that argues women should do all of the laundry or all of the housework or feel this guilt or feel like superheroes. In fact, I'm arguing quite the opposite. This idea of perfection, this idea of being always on for your employer, always on for your children, being the superhero is exactly what is setting women up for failure. When I say I feel I've been able to have it all, in my definition of having it all, which I'm very, very clear, again, is my definition of it, there are a lot of those things I simply don't do.
So are you saying, Sarah Lacey, that the reason, the way you're defining having it all isn't in this system of I can have enough time and a fulfilling, incredible relationship with my children and have enough time to have a career? It's that you've defined outside of what you feel like is the paradigm or even dichotomy that's set up by patriarchy, what having it all means just for yourself, and that you've been able to use that to then turn the lens back on the patriarchy.
Yeah, again, itself. I mean, there's a bake sale at my kid's school today. I assure you I was not up baking brownies last night. I mean, this is what I mean when I talk about this idea of perfection. I don't think anyone should be wearing a cape. I mean, I think taking off the cape and asking for help and not trying to be a superhero is as the caller just said, is an amazing, amazing lesson for working moms. I think it's interesting just observing a lot of like trigger points and anger in this conversation. Again, I kind of think this is how women have been divided against each other on this issue.
Well, Kim, thank you for bringing that in and sparking this conversation. Mike writes, if the problem is the patriarchy, why are the norms enforced chiefly by women? I don't know if that's true, but do men really talk up the advantages of being a stay-at-home mom more than women do?
Yes. I mean, sorry, Mike. But yes, first off, pressure comes from a lot of sides. Mommy wars was a big topic of the last 10 years online. We've certainly seen a lot of that anger play out on this show. But no, first of all, it is men who are making the bulk of the hiring and promotion decisions, funding decisions in Silicon Valley. Only 3% of venture-backed companies have female CEOs, a smaller percentage of them mothers. So yes, there are men that are making this decision. That is a lot of why there's a wage gap. I mean, there's endless sort of stats in the book and sort of freely available everywhere on that. But I think there's also this idea of you look at the really wealthy, successful men in our ecosystem and probably most ecosystems, most of them have stay-at-home wives. And when I was pregnant with Eli and talking to a lot of founders and entrepreneurs and venture capitalists, they all said to me, well, we didn't want strangers raising our kids. And I think that pressure is put on women where, a lot of what we're talking about and this sort of tension and anger that's coming out is because realistically, for most of us, me included, we have to work. It is not a choice. And so we can get upset with each other and we can get upset on definitions, but we all have to work and we're all doing the best for our families and the best for ourselves. But there's a lot of pressure put on women who are lucky enough to be able to have options that somehow there's something wrong with them if they want a life that's just theirs. And, you know, that's coming from men.
Well, Annie writes, the most egregious form of benevolent sexism I experienced was at the hand of a female boss who did not have children.
Mm-hmm. It's yeah, like I mean, that's a big part of benevolent sexism. And I write a lot about the book, this sort of queen bee idea. And there's been research that has shown that a lot of what creates that is this sort of sense that it's a zero-sum game and there's only one rule, one chair for the woman at that table, and how women are turned against each other. And she's absolutely right. It's benevolent sexism at work.
Well, I think the other thing that you were pointing out is that it's particularly difficult when because what you say is when people are trying to defend the patriarchy, they're constantly looking to women's voices to support their notions of it mm-hmm. because it sounds more genuine or more real if it comes from a woman. And so they're also put in this position as well. Well, let me take some more calls. Let's go to Claire in San Rafael. Hi, Claire.
Hi. I am a mid-60s lifelong feminist who's recently retired and spent my life hoping for somebody like Sarah to come along and be so clear-minded about all the problems that women face in having equal opportunity. And I'm just so thrilled to hear it so clearly stated, the difference between the benevolent and the negative sexism. It's all there. And unless our society listens to her and people get behind that, it's going to continue. But I'm feeling so hopeful now that it's finally maybe going to happen, because it's people like her who are so clear thinking about it and stating exactly what the problems are.
Thanks, Claire. I guess what I'm hearing also, Sarah, is that you're almost saying that Sheryl Sandberg's lean in is trying to help women make the best of the existing system. And are you saying that you just want to overthrow the existing
system?
Yeah,
I think that's our fundamental philosophical disagreement.
I see.
And that's my issue with the 50-50 marriage. Let me be clear. I am all for husbands who want to do lots of laundry. What I have an issue with is women who are given the advice, here's how to sell your husband on doing laundry so you can work. And people who are saying the answer is having a supportive spouse, because there's a lot of single mothers. There's a lot of mothers who have spouses where if they went in and with that checklist and said, look, Sheryl Sandberg will tell you that you'll have sex more if you do more laundry. You know, that argument may not exactly resonate with their husbands. You can't open Amazon and order a 50-50 spouse. I think it is a dissatisfying answer.
Well, let's go to Jane in San Francisco. Hi, Jane.
Hi, and I'm going to build on that conversation just a bit because, well, first of all, I just want to say, Sarah, I'm a CEO in the tech world, and I just want to thank you. You've been such an inspiration, and you've fought the fight for so many of us that are trying to make it in this very hostile world for environment for us. So thank you so much. But I'm going to build on that idea of not just 50-50 marriage, but 50-50 in the workspace. Because what I hear is a lot of hostility and anger because so much of the responsibility for caring for children or caring for family in general is put on us. And it feels like if we don't have equality in the home, we'll never have it in the workplace because child care is left to us. You know, home care, parent care is left to us. So one of the things that is also in the U.S. we don't get that other countries offer is paternity leave. Mm-hmm. So shouldn't we be fighting for paternity leave and equal care so that men also have this responsibility and they have to come home and take care of these things? And it's not just seen as our responsibility in the workplace, because that's where we get left out.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, thank you so much for the kind words. And I'm so glad that you're sort of in this fight as well. But I think that's why I talked about with Iceland. It's like what I find so innovative of their program is the family loses 3 months if the dad doesn't take it. I think putting the onus on everyone in the family to do their part is really important, particularly with, you know, elderly parents. I mean, I've talked to a lot of men who felt like they couldn't even take time from work in order to take care of older parents. But one thing I want to point out, you know, a couple years ago when I was starting this book, Netflix announced that it had the most generous paternal leave. You could take up to a year, mother or father. You could do that in any way you wanted. And it's interesting, a lot of conservative female columnist said that was a cruel policy because children would bond so much in a year that it would become intolerable. I mean, it is amazing the voices that come out even when we try to companies on their own dime try to create systems that will incentivize mothers and fathers to take that time and normalize and come back when they want to come back. People, there are a lot of forces in this country that do not want the system to be easier for women to gain economic equality.
Well, here's some interesting comments. Lilo writes, I think this eventually needs to be dealt with economically rather than an ideological debate. When you say you're combating patriarchy, a lot of men will bristle. But when you say you want to make it easier for parents to care for their kids, most people will be receptive, at least those men or women with children, which is a lot of people. Another listener writes, dads who choose to care for kids full-time face huge consequences from this patriarchal system, too. Signed, a stay-at-home dad who opted out of the Silicon Valley rat race for 6 years.
Totally great. A lot of men are victims of this hyper-toxic masculinity bro culture as well, and also want to have balance and be able to be home with their kids. That's one reason I'm so excited about the millennial wave, who are the biggest group of parents right now, because a lot of the dads do want to be super present, and a lot of the moms just will not take the same treatment that Gen X women like me took.
Well, let's hear from Alex in San Francisco. Hi, Alex.
Hey, I just wanted to thank your guest. Really interesting conversation. And I just wanted to put out my own experience, which is that I've only ever worked for women, and I'm not in a position to be promoting or not promoting anybody. And I kind of wonder what sort of position can do to sort of advance the cause of taking down the patriarchy.
Having only worked for women?
And just not being in a position to be making decisions that can affect women's lives yet, but just sort of, I think there's a lot of people who aren't bosses.
Yeah.
Who are listening and wanting to help.
Absolutely. I think that's a great question. I mean, like, taking down a patriarchy is obviously a big goal. And frankly, I like that it's something men bristle at, but it's sort of done intentionally. But I not you, to the previous comment. But I think it's little things that get us there. I mean, any social justice movements really come from lots and lots and lots of little things. My parents are from Memphis. I recently went back there and went to the Civil Rights Museum, which, you know, it was in the aftermath of Charlottesville, and I couldn't imagine a more important way for me to spend an afternoon in sort of the state I felt. And it was just the relentlessness of small actions that amounted into large actions was really what jumped out at me. So, you know, I think that everyone is in a position to do little things to kick a dent in the patriarchy every day. I think, you know, supporting women when they're talked over in a meeting and then amplifying them. I think some of the women who've called in who felt like they were put in untenable situations, asking them if they need help, asking if you can help pick up their kids, asking what they need from you, or just telling them you think they're killing it and doing an amazing job. There's so many little things we can do every day to make women feel more supported.
Sarah Lacey, journalist, tech entrepreneur, and author. Her book is A Uterus is a Feature, Not a Bug, The Working Woman's Guide to Overthrowing the Patriarchy. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
And thanks to our listeners for their comments and questions and pushback. I really push the conversation. Have a great weekend. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.